If you turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 15, a passage that Jonathan read to us a short time ago, Matthew chapter 15, if you're using one of the blue Bibles, that's on page 692, page 692. And we're going to be looking at Matthew 15 verses 1 to 20 as we continue in our study, looking at Matthew's gospel and how he writes of his eyewitness account of the person of Jesus Christ and all that he did and his testimony of him. What makes you British? Maybe you're not. I'm making an assumption there. What makes you maybe English or Irish or Welsh or whatever other nationalities we have here? How do you identify what it is to be part of that culture or part of that nation? Now, if you followed our nation's sporting efforts the past week, sadly, then the press would have you believe that England's football team's poor performance raises questions about our national identity. Did you know that? Isn't that extraordinary how a football team can affect what we are as a country? So if we're not known for winning football, then what is being English all about? Well, frightening. Or perhaps, maybe more seriously, you've followed the arguments and politics over the past, I guess, number of years. Arguments, discussions around immigration, and what is the effect that it has on our culture and our country, and the impact on that. Now, that's not the time or place to debate that at all. That's not my intent to make any political comments at all. But when someone comes into our environment, you know, whether that's our country or maybe our school or our neighborhood, new neighbors, or, hey, maybe our church, and maybe they come from a different background and they do things differently, we start to ask questions, don't we? They do things differently. Why do you do things that way? Why don't you do things the way that we do them? What's good about the way you do it? The way we do it is surely better, etc. Why don't you do it the way that we do it? Well, that's kind of what's been going on in Jesus' time here, 2,000 years ago, as we see in Matthew. It's not so much, I guess, does he fit into the culture and the nation, but it's more a question of righteousness and what does it mean to be righteous. And there were different views and opinions about that, as I'm sure, probably even today, but in our culture, there are different views of right and wrong and what that is. But in that time, in a culture and a nation who particularly took pride in their identity, and for some of them in particular, the Pharisees in particular, they took great efforts and pride in keeping the law of God. Now, we've probably seen that as we've come through Matthew. Or at least in trying to keep it, trying to keep God's law. And Jesus doesn't seem to quite fit with that as we come to this chapter 15 here. Matthew tells us of this, and the conflict that arises here we see in Matthew 15 is between, on the one hand, the Pharisees and teachers of the law, and on the other hand, between Jesus. And if you follow when Jonathan read, you will see that at least on the surface, the conflict seems to be about why Jesus' disciples, and then presumably Jesus himself, why do they not keep certain traditions as dictated by the religious leaders of the time? Why do they not keep those traditions? Why don't they fit in? Surely this is the right way to do things. You know, we can perhaps try and imagine and understand something of what had been going on. Again, if you've not been here with us as we've gone through Matthew, do take a time to flick back this afternoon. But cast your mind back. Jesus is well known at this stage in this environment. He's a well-known character. He's known not least as a miracle worker and as a teacher. In fact, so widely known is he that even in the past chapter, if you flick back just chapter 14 and just cast your eye over that, you'll see that Herod has heard about Jesus and he's pretty confused about who he is. But he's heard about Jesus, this character, and all that he's done. We also see that there's a crowd of more than 5,000 people followed him way out into the countryside to see him. And they were miraculously fed by him. More than 5,000 people. Then we see at the end of chapter 14, again, after Jesus dismisses them, and he walks across on the water, and in verse 34 and 35, again, people from all around the area came to see Jesus when they heard where he was. He was well known at that time. So it's not a surprise, I guess, in 15 verse 1, that we see the religious leaders in Jerusalem, you can imagine them sat in their high offices, also hearing all that Jesus is doing, hearing the reports. So they send their delegation or their deputation to Jesus all the way from Jerusalem to go and question him and to challenge him. And the challenge they come with in verse 2, take a look at verse 2 there, the challenge they come with is, as we say, why do your disciples break the traditions of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat. Now, this is coming from Pharisees and the teachers. These are the religious leaders of the time. These are the guys who, they should be upholding God's law. They're responsible for keeping God's law and for teaching others about it. That's their role. But as we will see this being unpacked, and as you may well know, in their determination to keep God's law, they surrounded God's commands with layer upon layer of their own rules and traditions and regulations and so on and so on. So these acted like a fence or like a hedge around God's law. And the idea was that if I didn't break any of these outer traditions or hedges or break these other laws, then of course I wouldn't get anywhere near to breaking God's law, so I'd be far safer. Well, you can see there might be some common sense in that, mightn't there? Some safety. So, modern day example. What's the motorway speed limit? I'll test you on this one. 70. So, let's just say you're driving down the motorway, and the legal limit is 70, and you say to yourself, just to make sure I don't drift above 70, I'm going to drive at 60, just as a safeguard. Well, that's a sensible thing to do, isn't it? What have I said? I said a sensible thing, so maybe, yeah, no comment on it. That might be a sensible thing to do. It might give me some kind of safety checks before I actually break the law. But then you can see how it becomes very easy, doesn't it, for me to be driving at 60, nicely and calmly, of course, and suddenly feeling very self-righteous with all these guys flying past me at 65, or even 70, let alone the 80. And I can be very self-righteous and condemn them and judge others who go perhaps a bit faster than I have, but they've not broken the law. A trivial example, but that's precisely what the Pharisees were doing. So you can see for them, as it would be for us at driving 60 on the motorway, it's very easy for us to turn our own rules and regulations and traditions and practices and start to judge others and ourselves, I guess, actually, by those standards, rather than according to God's law and according to how good we are keeping those and not how good we are at serving God and keeping his laws. So we create these artificial fences, don't we? So in connection with washing hands, the question in verse 2 here that the Pharisees bring, it seems that what the Pharisees had done is that they had taken God's ceremonial laws about washing, where they were to wash specifically, before particular ceremonies and duties. And they took that and they extended it to make their own rules and traditions to say, okay, now you've got to wash your hands before every single meal. Okay, we've got some more regulations here. Now, kids, your ears are pricking up here. I can tell that. Washing your hands before eating any meal. Now, the reason we wash our hands before eating any meal is why? It's simply to do with hygiene, isn't it? And outward cleanliness. It's just to make sure that when I come in from the garden and I've been digging, I don't end up with mud in my mouth and mud on the tablecloth and things like that, and passing germs around. That's a simple reason. But for the Pharisees, they turned this into something which is not about cleaning your hands before you eat. It was not about not eating with grubby hands. It was not about hygiene. But for them, it was a matter of inward purity or impurity. For them, the tradition stated that you could become, or you would become unclean or impure, spiritually defiled. You become sinful if you had not washed your hands before eating. And the accusation so here in verse 2 is that Jesus' disciples were not keeping that. Well, come on, guys. Therefore, you're not as righteous as we are. So the issue seems to be actually one of God's authority versus man's authority. Now, Jesus doesn't answer the question of washing hands, interesting, until verse 11. But his first answer, the first challenge he comes to is about the first point, the hypocrisy of outward religion. We'll come back to the washing the hands later on in verse 11. But he challenges the Pharisees here in verse 3 to show them how far off the mark they've actually got, how far off they are. And he warns them that all of their outward religion, all of these rules, this is hypocrisy. This is crazy. They are so wrapped up in their own laws and their own traditions. They're so focused on keeping the externals, their own standards. They're focused on keeping these fences and these other hedge laws they've put around them that they've lost sight of God's commands and what God wants from them. And they've ended up actually putting their own laws, as Jesus says, above God's law. Look at the example Jesus uses. It's a fairly intricate example, but let's just skim through it to make sure we understand it from verses 3 to verse 6. Jesus refers to the fifth commandment as he replies to them in verse 4, where God commands, honor your father and mother. And anyone who curses his father and mother must be put to death. This is a serious command and something which God takes seriously. So the clear command and requirement from God is that we honor our parents, that we respect our parents. But in contrast, Jesus says in verse 5, but you say, Pharisees, you've made your own laws or traditions. You've come up with your own additional things, which in essence allows someone to give to God what they would normally have used to care for their parents. Now, I won't go into details of this. The commentaries are to turn your mind around and round and round and round. And this is exactly what the laws at this time had done. They had made so many laws around the core laws of God that they would get themselves into an absolute twist. But the essence here is that it might be, for example, financial support. The Pharisees would say that actually in their law or tradition, which should be kept, even if it meant that you were no longer able to honor your parents by taking care of them. So it might be better for me to take my money and give it to the church than to use my money to care for my parents if they would need that. So they created other laws which are better. In their eyes, it's far better to keep the traditions of the Pharisees and to uphold our own view of our religion and our righteousness. It's far better to do that than to obey God's commands. Well, Jesus says in verse 7, you hypocrites. What a stinging remark that is. He says to them, you claim to be keeping all these rules and traditions as a service to God. That's what they're claiming. They're not keeping for themselves. They claim it to be to God. But you put your own authority above God's. You put your own view of right and wrong and your own view of religion, your own traditions above what God has put there. And he quotes there Isaiah. Isaiah was right, Jesus says in verse 8. When he prophesied about you, these people honor me with their lips, as we looked at with the children, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me, but in vain, and their teachings are but rules taught by men. Well, what a stinging rebuke that must have been to the Pharisees, and I guess to any of us who look at that and say, does that apply to us? Now, Matthew tells us a few verses later on that the Pharisees were rattled by that rebuke. And sometime later, when maybe later that day, the disciples came to Jesus in verse 12 and said, Jesus, do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard that? No surprise that they were. You know, Jesus uses one example here, doesn't he, in those verses? And it probably does seem an example which is very far removed to us. We don't have these Pharisaical laws, do we? Well, not the same ones, no. But there's a warning here and a judgment to the Pharisees that should make us all sit up and take note. Because it's easy for us, isn't it, to read a passage like this and to look back and to judge the Pharisees and say, goodness me, how stupid they were. How could they get themselves into that situation? How could they be so crazy as to take their eye off God's commands and to start to pay more attention to their own expectations and their own view of righteousness? It's easy for us to see their hypocrisy or hypocrisy of other people, maybe other churches, other Christians, especially when it's pointed out to us so clearly as in these verses. And easy to say, well, you know, we modern evangelicals, we've got it right. We don't have traditions, do we? No traditions, no other laws for us to keep, etc. Well, we ought not to have. And that's the message, isn't it? That's the message. But there's a warning for us there too. How easy it could be for us to suddenly have all sorts of other expectations which we put on ourselves in terms of things we do. Maybe it's meetings we go to, the ways we do church, etc., etc. And there might be valid things, but we turn them into being things which are essentials or more important. And we can judge others sometimes wrongly if they don't adhere to them. So is my religion, is my Christianity, is it merely outward? Do Isaiah's words describe you? Do they describe me? There's a challenge there, isn't it? I'm challenged by that. Maybe we enjoy coming to church on Sunday. Maybe you sung the hymns this morning and you enjoy reading the passages. You say the right things in public conversations with friends, with neighbors. Outwardly, you would appear to be a good Christian person. Your outward life seems fairly respectable. But is it all outward religion? Is it all outward religion for us? Would God say of you, as he did say of the people in Isaiah's time, you honor me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. Where is your heart? Do you love the Lord with your heart? Would God say to you and to me, but you worship me in vain. You sing the songs. You sing the words. You say amen, the prayers. You turn up, but your heart is far from me. What are we to be like if we are to call ourselves true Christians and to understand true righteousness, true holiness, to say that we are disciples of Jesus? What are we to be like? Well, I think the message here is we are to take God's word really seriously, as we find it in the Bible, and to obey him wholeheartedly, to focus on what he says, and to focus on obeying him not just with our lips, but with our hearts too. And not only when it's convenient, but to obey when it's not convenient, when it's difficult, when it means, I've got to change my lifestyle. I need to change my priorities. To obey willingly, not as we said with the kids, well, go and tidy my bedroom, but to obey God willingly when he puts his finger on areas in our lives and asks us to do things. And to obey always, not just sometimes, but to obey from our hearts. True righteousness doesn't come from outward religion, is what Jesus is teaching here. Now, having dealt with the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, as he does here, and all the legalism that they upheld, Jesus now in verse 10, he starts to address the question of, okay, but why don't they wash their hands? So he still hasn't really got out of that question, has he? Hasn't he sidestepped that? Why don't the disciples wash their hands? Isn't this something they should be doing? But it's not a simple question of, why don't they wash their hands? But it is actually more about, can someone become unrighteous or unclean, is the term they use here, or impure or sinful, spiritually impure, by not washing their hands, which is what the Pharisees taught. So in verse 10, you see a change of pace here, where the Pharisees have come to him, and he's spoken to them in verses 1 to 9. Now he calls the crowds to him, aware that the crowds have been subject in hearing the Pharisees' false teaching. So he's dealt with the Pharisees head on. Now, bring the crowds around. Now, let's try and correct their understanding and make sure that they get the right picture. And look what he says. He wants them to take really careful notes here. He's not simply going to refute the teaching of the Pharisees, but there's something else he wants them to understand, something really, really key, which applies to us here. And that is what our second point will be, is that the heart is the source of sin. It's the heart that is the source of sin. Look at what he says in verse 10. Listen and understand, Jesus says. That's a classic opening phrase we see, don't we? Sometimes he says, truly, truly, I say to you. Take note here. Listen carefully and understand, he says. And there are two things he says in verse 11. What goes into a man's mouth, he says, does not make him unclean, but what comes out of his mouth, that is what makes him unclean. So the first statement there corrects the Pharisees. Jesus says, you're not made spiritually unclean, you're not made impure, you're not made sinful by what goes into your mouth. Okay? He's corrected the Pharisees. So whether you wash your hands before you eat or not, it doesn't make a difference spiritually. Whether you wash your hands or not does not make a difference spiritually. In verse 17, Peter asks him to explain this. You can almost see a bit of puzzlement, but hang on, all these traditions, we've been told that this is the case. Can you clarify this for us? What does that mean? What does Jesus say in verse 17, where he further explains that? He says, verse 16, "Are you still so dull?" Jesus asked them. "Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body?" It's almost as if Jesus is saying, look, can't you see it? Step back. You've got food. You eat it. It goes into your stomach and it comes out your body when you go to the toilet. It's as simple as that. This is physical. How can that defile you? How can that make you spiritually unclean? But in his second statement, back in verse 11, Jesus puts his finger on what does make someone unclean. He doesn't want the crowds or the Pharisees to think that you can't be unclean before God. You can, and this is the point. Listen, he says, it's important that you understand that there is something that makes you unclean. There is something that makes you unrighteous, not right before God. What does he say in verse 11? What comes out of your mouth, that is what makes a man him unclean. And as he further explains in verse 18, what does that mean? What comes out of your mouth comes from your heart. What comes from your mouth comes from your heart. It comes from within, doesn't it? And that's what makes you unclean. The heart is the source of sin. Well, it's no surprise that the Pharisees were offended, is it? I don't know if you find that offensive. Why were they offended? Well, because it cuts right through all of these rules and traditions which they had, all of these things which they thought would prevent them from being unclean. If I keep these rules, then I won't be breaking God's law and I'll be righteous. And actually, I've got all my other rules outside, so aren't I a good bloke? But it cuts right through that, doesn't it? It tells them that actually, their outward religion and our outward religion, all the things we think we can do, is worthless. Because right inside, inside my heart, inside your heart, our hearts are sinful. It's no wonder that Jesus said, listen and understand. Because he's identified here the root cause of being unclean. The root problem that makes you and I unrighteous, that makes us not fit for God. That means we are not acceptable before God. So it's not breaking laws or traditions or doing things that makes us unclean. It's not what we eat that makes us unclean. Our hearts are unclean. Now that, for the Pharisees, I hope you can see, and for the crowds, and for the disciples, but for you and for me, is a big problem. Isn't it? Isn't that a big problem? Because if there is something external that makes me sinful, well then maybe I can prevent it from affecting me. Maybe I can wash my hands. Maybe I can keep certain rules. Maybe I can not do certain things. Maybe I can not eat certain things. It's external. I can keep it away from me. Maybe I could lock myself up in an island and be a hermit. But Jesus says, no, verse 19. Out of the heart, verse 19, he says, for out of the heart come evil thoughts. Murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. These are what make a man unclean. The problem for you and me is that our hearts are sinful. Our hearts are sinful. What is in the heart will come out and will show the heart for what it is, unclean and full of sin. Are you aware of the sinfulness of your own heart? Are you aware of that? Do you see it? The sin and corruption in your own heart? Do you see yourself as being full of murder and adultery and sexual immorality and theft and false testimony and slander? If you do, then that's a good sign. And it means that God's Spirit has worked or is working in you to convict you of your sin. If you don't, can I ask you to please, as Jesus said, listen and understand. Listen, take note. Your heart is sinful. It needs to be dealt with. Oh, you know, I can say my heart's not really that bad. Come on. I think you're pushing this a bit. You know, it's just the influence and temptation of the world which makes me bad. You know, if it wasn't for all of that stuff which I see on telly or my friends at school or those around me, they're just a bad influence on me. I'm actually pretty good inside. Well, that's not what Jesus said. Jesus, the Son of God, who with piercing eyes, he sees right into our hearts, doesn't he? He sees into your heart and to my heart. There's no hiding from him. He says, no, the heart, your heart, is the source of sin. Or you may say, looking at verse 19, yeah, but I'm not that bad. That's for the really bad guys who end up in prison, the guys who have killed and murdered and done the really bad stuff. I'm not that bad. That's someone who's far worse than I am. Well, that's not true either. Keep a finger here, but also will you turn back to Matthew chapter 5, which we looked at a few months back. Matthew chapter 5. So, Jesus says in the passage we're looking at today, he talks about murder. Well, I haven't murdered anybody. I've never killed anybody. What does Jesus say in Matthew 5 and verse 21? You have heard that it was said to people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raka, a term of rebuke, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. See, Jesus says, it's more than just keeping the rule, I didn't murder. What's in my heart? My heart is full of evil intent. Do I love people? Do I hold hatred for people? Then I'm guilty of murder. What about adultery? Jesus talks about adultery in our passage today. Well, I've not committed adultery. But what does Jesus say in chapter 5 and verse 27? He says, you have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You see, it's in your heart. It's not just what you do. It's your intent and your motives and your desires in your heart. And what about adultery later on? He says in divorce, verse 31, he says, anyone who divorces his wife, it has been said, must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital faithfulness causes her to commit adultery. It's what's in your heart. It's not for us to put all these rules and regulations around ourselves and say, well, I haven't murdered, I haven't committed adultery, I haven't done these things. In the end of the day, Jesus says, your heart and my heart is sinful. What about false testimony and lying? Now, surely not one of us in this room could say we haven't lied. That would be a lie in itself. Not many of us could say, or one of us could say, that we haven't slandered, we haven't accused someone wrongly of what they've done. We haven't maligned their character. We haven't spoken ill of people behind their backs. There's not one of us here this morning who can say in all honesty, in all truth, that our hearts are free from sin. Well, that's a stark picture, isn't it? That's a stark picture. If my heart and if your heart is so corrupted, if it's so unclean, then what hope is there for us? What hope is there for my heart? What hope is there for me to be right with God? How can I be right with God? Are you offended by that, as the Pharisees were, or are you humbled by it? Are you surprised at such strong words from Jesus? Maybe we were expecting more miracles and more healings and more positive things, and now we get this. Are you surprised at such strong words? Well, you know, sometimes strong words are needed to make us see the truth of a situation, aren't they? To see the truth of our hearts and to turn us around. Jesus didn't just come to perform miracles. He didn't just come to heal. He didn't just come to teach. He came to die on the cross for you and for me. Not as an example, but as a substitute. He came to take your place and my place. To take the punishment that you deserve and I deserve because of the sin in my heart. What did Jesus say? He said he came to seek and save those who were lost. You and I are lost until we are found by him. People like us, young people, children, middle-aged people, older folks, whichever category you want to put yourself in, every one of us here in this room are people with sinful hearts who need forgiveness and who need to be rescued and who need new hearts. That's the only answer. Can I turn you to Psalm 51 as we close? Turn to Psalm 51. If you're using one of the blue Bibles, it's on page 404. Psalm 51, page 404. I'd just like us to read through that together as we contemplate this message, and we think about where we stand before God. We've been singing this morning already about and thinking about how do we approach God How can we approach God? Well, not through our own works, not through our own righteousness, but only by His grace. We sang God of grace, amazing wonder. We've sung of the need to have our hearts changed. We sang, purify my heart. We've asked God to change us by His Spirit. And we sang, create in me a clean heart, O God. Let me read, and if you would follow Psalm 51, a Psalm of David, where he writes, picking up this theme, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are proved right when you speak and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. Surely you desire truth in the inner parts. You teach me wisdom in the inmost place. Cleanse me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have crushed rejoice. Hide your face from my sins, and blot out all my iniquity. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Then I will teach transgressors your ways and sinners will turn back to you. Save me from blood guilt, O God, the God who saves me, and my tongue will sing of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips and my mouth will declare your praise. You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, you will not despise.